Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There is nothing like a little fresh mountain air to get the creative juices going, to really make you want to take on the big questions that life hands you. So we're going to do some of that today, economy-wise. We're at the Aspen Ideas Festival this week from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Aspen Institute in Aspen, Colorado, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Thursday, everybody. It's the last day of June today. And we are here in the Rocky Mountains this week for the Aspen Ideas Festival, a chance to take a break from the everyday rush of events and think, in the final analysis, about how to make things better. Before we get to that, though, the news of the day forces us to take a detour from the wide open spaces and fresh air of Colorado and remember our etymology, because it is in times of crisis that we realize our debt to the Greek language. The very word crisis is derived from the Greek. So too, drama, climax, pandemonium, chaos, and tragedy, all of which have come into play over the past few weeks as worries over Greek government debt have grown. Here, though, is another word of Greek origin, catharsis. And that seems to be the dominant mood in Berlin and Paris today, because the parliament in Athens has finally approved an austerity package, and with it, a way to avoid, again from the Greek, catastrophe. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Today's vote gives the go-ahead for tax hikes, budget cuts, and privatizations. Without them, the European Union and the IMF would have denied Greece the next chunk of its bailout money. Jan Randolph of IHS Global Insight says Greece has staved off default and disaster, at least for now.
The way now is clear for the release of the next lump of money, which will keep Greece afloat till about September. So we have a short-term breathing space, basically, a sigh of relief for a few months until the next possible cliffhanger.
But another cliffhanger seems a certainty. 80% of the Greek public opposes the austerity package. So do the opposition parties. So, in fact, do most members of the ruling party. Holger Schmieding is with the German bank Berenberg.
So in the implementation of what the Greek parliament has passed over the last 2 days lie still a few significant hurdles.
Who, for example, will want to buy state-owned companies packed with hostile workers? And how do you raise more tax revenue in a country that seems allergic to paying tax? Eurozone economist Megan Green predicts another crisis soon.
Come September, when the EU, the ECB and the IMF descend on Athens for their quarterly review of how Greece is doing on implementing all the terms of the bailout, they're going to have a very hard time coming up with positive things to say.
And that'll mean more ultimatums in the fall, with Greece once again teetering on the brink. At least the politicians and the protesters can spend the rest of the summer on the beach. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There are no second acts, it's been said, in American lives. But F. Scott Fitzgerald must not have known much about the American economy, because one of the biggest economic second acts ever wraps up today. QE2, quantitative easing to the Federal Reserve's $600 billion economic rescue effort, is over and done with. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has that story from New York.
Quantitative easing is pretty much a giant shopping spree for the Federal Reserve. The Fed buys bonds, mostly U.S. Treasury bonds. Basically, we're buying our own debt. Since QE2 started, the Fed has bought 85% of the T-bills the U.S. has issued. That pushes money into the economy, hopefully creating jobs and spurring growth. So, did it work?
I think on balance, QE2 was a net positive for the economy.
Economist Michelle Meyer with Bank of America Merrill Lynch.
That helped bring around a rally in the stock market that supports the corporate sector.
Since the Fed started its buying, markets have soared, and there's been a spike in mergers and stock offerings. But not everybody thinks that makes the policy a success. Marilyn Cohen is a money manager and author of Surviving the Bond Bear Market. She says it did a lot of damage.
Global investors looked around and said, oh my gosh, the Federal Reserve is going to be buying a bunch of treasuries. This means inflation is here. And that's why they sold the dollar and went into stronger currencies.
Cohen says that's part of the reason food and fuel prices have gotten so high. And then there's unemployment and housing, which QE2 hasn't been able to budge. Still, economist Lawrence White with NYU's Stern School of Business says without the Fed's help, it would have been a lot worse.
I'm quite convinced unemployment would have been even higher in the absence of QE2.
The difficulty now, White says, is how the bond market and the economy will survive without the Treasury's best customer. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Down in the canyons of Wall Street, which I'll tell you feels about a million miles away from the mountains here in Aspen, the major indices had another fine day. We will have the details when we do the numbers.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Aspen, where the local time here is approximately 1:15.
The moment the little plane you're on descends down into Aspen, feels like you're in a different place. The mountains still have snow on them. It was a tough winter here, apparently. The valleys are lush and green. All of it is beneath a pale blue sky and fluffy white clouds. And then you notice row upon row upon row of private jets parked at the airport. And you know you're in a different place. Aspen is best known as a playground for the rich and the beautiful. And a lot of people are pretty good looking here. Not everybody's rich, though. Sociologist David Pello wrote a book called Slums of Aspen.
There are really two Aspens, one for people who are there for relaxation and rest and recreation, for, you know, the Aspen Music Festival, the Food and Wine Classic, those sorts of things. And there's another Aspen for people whose labor makes that all possible.
Aspen is about as full-fledged a service economy as you're ever going to find. There's the skiing, of course. In the summertime, there's whitewater rafting, trail tours, paragliding over the peaks. Not to mention the dozens and dozens of restaurants and bars, coffee shops, and retail outlets that sell everything from ski pants to evening gowns. All of them staffed by guides, bartenders, waiters, and housekeepers, few of whom can actually afford to live here in town. Wolfgang Taylor gets by driving a taxi out to the airport.
Jobs, better here in Aspen, a lot more jobs. But we live down valley because it's cheaper.
The median home price here is $4 million. $4 million. But everything else is marked up too. Gas, food, medicine, all of it. So most, like Wolfgang Taylor said, live down valley. That'd be the Roaring Fork River Valley that you can hear behind me. They live in towns like Basalt and Carbondale and Glenwood Springs. A commute that by bus can take more than an hour. So to keep as many of those workers, which includes nurses and firemen and cops too, in town, or at least closer to it, there are subsidies for transportation, childcare, and housing.
When your community costs four times that of the average American city, you have to subsidize the working population. We wouldn't have a resort without the working population.
Nan Sundin's the director of Health and Human Services for Pitkin County, which includes Aspen and a lot of those towns down valley that I mentioned. She says there is another thing that happens when a lot of locals work in the service industry, usually for smaller companies that often don't offer benefits.
The Roaring Fork Valley has the highest rate of uninsured people in the state of Colorado.
About 30,000 people live in the valley. Of that, about a quarter of them have no insurance. The funny thing about Aspen, though, is that while you'd figure it's frustrating to live a low or middle or even normal income existence here in a town dotted with multi-million dollar homes and $65 a plate steak dinners, you don't really hear much complaining. For better or worse, says the county's Nan Sundin, the place just works.
You have to make a choice to live here, and it's very expensive for the working population, and they give up things. And if people aren't willing to do that, they don't stay.
Jimmy's restaurant and bar is packed with millionaires and ski bums alike who come for fish tacos and a shot of tequila with the owner. Jimmy is Jimmy Yeager. He's from back east long ago. He's been here for about 20 years. And he says, when prodded, economic disparity? What economic disparity?
The reality is very simple. It's this. We hike the same trails. We ski the same mountain. We eat and drink in the same restaurant and bars.
And if you're not inclined to take Jimmy Yeager's word for it, here's Nan Sundin.
What we have found in Pitkin County surveys is that those two populations share a lot of values.
Or as Nan Sundin says, whether you're on the trail, the ski lift, or an event like the Aspen Ideas Festival, it's not surprising to find everybody at the same party. Aspen this week is a place in which, almost by decree, big thoughts are thunk and big ideas are imagined. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore has been immersed in the panels and all the Ideas Festival comings and goings, so we've asked her to come by and share a little bit. Hey, Heidi.
Hey, Kai.
So last year, this festival, at least to my mind, was all about the recession. It was about the financial crisis. It was about, you know, stuff that was sort of in the past. I get the impression from what you and I have been talking about and some of the panels that it's more about external stuff now, about our place in the global economy.
That's a pretty good observation. That's exactly what everyone's been obsessed with. And in fact, it's pretty funny. Some of the sessions have been on happiness, and I wonder if it's because we have nothing left to do for the economy, so we might as well just feel better. But I think that one of the things that most people are concerned about is how competitive the U.S. can remain in an economy where we are highly indebted and you have really big, important emerging market nations like China, Brazil, and India coming up behind us. And the consensus is we are probably going to have to lose a little bit of standing in order to gain economic growth.
Play that out a little bit. I mean, what exactly are they talking about?
Well, they're talking about things, for instance, like Liaquat Ahmed, who wrote the book Lords of Finance, he talked about how in the United States, we expect to be number one. And what that means is we carry the burden of global stability, and we may just have to give up that burden. Here's Ahmed.
It's not just us simply setting the rules and then through a process of carrots and sticks, getting everyone to follow the rules. It's going to be countries trying to influence us and using carrots and sticks to us. And we're going to have to swallow our pride occasionally.
So what Ahmed also added there afterwards is that why are we so obsessed with being number one? What are the true benefits? You can look at countries like Sweden, a lot of the Scandinavian countries, or France. They're wealthy, happy countries, and they're not number one.
Talk to me about mechanics. How do we get to this place where we have innovation and we get to be okay not being number one?
Well, apparently we're going to talk our way out of it. Also known
Welcome
as
to the Ideas Festival.
That's right. Also known as diplomacy. Yeah. So I talked to Bob Hormats. He's a high-ranking official in the State Department. And he said that the State Department has been redoubling its efforts to lobby for U.S. businesses overseas. So whenever Hillary Clinton goes overseas or President Obama, they talk up American companies like Boeing, Caterpillar, IBM, and they try to get them to win contracts to build equipment in other countries.
Turn it inward for a second and talk to me about the domestic part of this, because we have, as you know, housing problems, joblessness problems. I mean, it's tough to see how this all fits in a context of an American economy still stuck.
That's absolutely right. And unemployment is the one thing we can't get around. Ahmed made a very good point. He said we have been the least activist of nations about our unemployment problem, and we have the smallest possible cushion for people to land on. I talked to Marty Seligman about this. He's a well-known psychologist on happiness issues, and he's been studying things like unemployment and resilience. He said when people are unemployed, they never really come back from it. Even after they have a job, they never have the same sense of well-being that they did before. So if you extrapolate that to a nation of 14 million people who are unemployed, this is a real crisis, not just financial, but also psychological, because this is the population that is going to have to rebuild the country after this crisis.
Right, and it plays into that thing we started with, which is our place in the global economy.
Exactly right.
Our New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore, up here at the Aspen Ideas Festival with us. Heidi, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, all right, wait a minute. How's the economy going to get back on track?
When economic recovery really starts to take place, it'll start from the community banks. It's not going to be J.P. Morgan leading the way out of this.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street gave a strong send-off to a fairly weak quarter today. The Dow Industrial jumped 1.25%, 152 points this Thursday. Blue chips closed at 12,414. The NASDAQ added 1.2%, 33 points, 27.73. The S&P 500 bumped up 1%, 13 points, finished things at 1320. Caps a quarter in which the Dow tacked on 0.8%, but the NASDAQ gave back 0.3%. The S&P 500 gave back 0.4% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note on this Thursday rose to 3.16%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for May. Automakers are scheduled to release U.S. sales numbers for June. And July is National Hot Dog Month. Grilling with friends? According to the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council, one should not send a thank you note following a hot dog barbecue. It would not be in keeping with the unpretentious nature of the dish. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We're pretty much obliged every month when it comes out to pass on to you a number that is officially called the Consumer Price Index. Inflation is the English translation. The CPI is useful for all kinds of things, from Social Security cost of living increases to what the Fed's going to do with interest rates. There is a school of thought, though, that says if the government just changed the way inflation is measured, it could save hundreds of billions of dollars over the next decade. An idea that you have to admit is pretty attractive right about now. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
To find out how we measure inflation, the government fills up a giant virtual shopping cart with all sorts of stuff. Food, college tuition, computers, cigarettes. Then the Labor Department adds it all together to see if that shopping cart costs more than it used to, and if inflation is going up. This is called the Consumer Price Index. Robert Greenstein heads the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He says the government uses this data to set
elements of the tax code, the dollar level at which each tax bracket ends and the next tax bracket begins, as well as things like Social Security benefits, veterans' benefits.
But many policy experts argue we should measure inflation differently. They say consumers change their behavior when stuff gets expensive. By not taking that into account, Mark Goldwein with the Committee for a Responsible Budget says,
we are undertaxing and overpaying Social Security benefits relative to the spirit of the law, relative to what we're supposed to be doing.
Jim Kessler is with Third Way, a centrist think tank. He says consumers know how to stretch their dollars.
When the price of one product goes up, oftentimes consumers will decide, well, I'll just buy another product that makes me just as happy. It's the idea that you might switch from hot dogs to hamburgers if the price of hot dogs goes way up.
If we take that into consideration, the rate of inflation is actually lower. And experts like Robert Greenstein say this could save the country around $300 billion over the next decade.
So the argument is, if we're overstating inflation and we have a more accurate measure of inflation, we ought to go to it, especially if that helps us with these very serious long-term fiscal problems we face.
There's a lot of support for using this formula, but not everyone likes the idea. Congressman Javier Becerra is a Democrat from Southern California. He says what some people call a technical change
is really a direct benefit cut.
Social Security payments would go down, but Third Way's Jim Kessler says not by much.
You know, for a senior citizen, what it would mean is one less meal with your grandkids at Applebee's over the course of a year.
But the AARP says it would add up over the years to a lot of dinners at Applebee's. David Certner is AARP's chief lobbyist.
If you were on Social Security, you may see a reduction of a few dollars in the first year, but that few dollars would compound over time, so that by the time you'd been on Social Security for, say, 15 years, you would probably be seeing 5% reductions in your benefits.
Certner says this would hit the oldest Americans hardest because they'd have less savings and higher health bills.
This is really a complicated issue.
Robert Greenstein says there is a solution. Measure inflation differently, reap most of the savings, but offer more government assistance to those who really need it. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
At As we speak, rumors are flying fast and furious back in Washington that there's a deal coming on the debt ceiling talks. So here's our own contribution to the reporting. Jack Lew, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, was supposed to be on the show tomorrow. We're doing it in front of a live audience at one of Aspen's finer nightclubs, but we got a call this morning that Mr. Lew's not going to be able to make it. Said he has to stay in Washington. So now we have a 5.5-minute hole in the broadcast, which is our problem, not yours, but at least there does seem to be some sanity returning to the politics of the American economy. New York Times columnists David Leonhardt and Jonah Serra write a lot about that and many other things in the paper, so we've asked them to come by and share their thoughts with us. Guys, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Ostensibly, David, it's good news that people in Washington are talking about an agreement on the debt limit and the debt ceiling. But the first thing I thought of when I heard all this talk this morning was a column you had in the paper the other day about us having to deal with the deficit we actually have versus the one we imagine we have. Play that out for me a little bit.
First of all, it certainly is good news. We need to raise the debt ceiling. It would send a terrible message if we didn't, but it doesn't solve our problems. The deficit we imagine is a deficit that's caused by spineless politicians and by oil subsidies and basically by all sorts of other people. The deficit we have is a deficit that's caused first by Medicare, second by Social Security, third, or maybe second, by historically low taxes, and fourth, by the military. And so the only way we're going to get a handle on our deficit is to make changes that are not popular.
Right. Joe, let me turn to you for a second. And the role of the banks in helping heal this economy, which one assumes is what a debt limit agreement will do. The banks are making most of their money now trading, not actually banking. They are in business, it seems, for themselves. How long can that continue as we try to get this economy back on track?
Well, the banks have a problem. Trading has been, for quite a while, their basic business. We're talking about the mega banks, mm-hmm. the too big to fail banks. It's what they do. Some of that, as Jamie Dimon likes to say, is done on behalf of clients that want, you know, swap deals. A lot of it's done on behalf of themselves. The problem banks have is that, you know, they still have a lot of bad stuff on their books. They are being punished, in some ways rightfully so, for the excesses of the subprime bubble, i.e. you saw the Bank of America $8.5 mm-hmm. billion dollar deal. There are going to be other deals like that. They have new capital requirements coming down the pike. They're actually kind of scared about what would happen if they open the spigot and really start lending in a big way. And I think you're going to see, when economic recovery really starts to take place, as is so often the case, it starts from the bottom up. It'll start from the community banks. It's not going to be J.P. Morgan leading the way out of this.
We are still in this country dealing with enormous personal debt loads, David. And how do we recover from the bottom up if consumers are still trying to deal with their debt?
Slowly. I think that's the first thing we need to keep in mind, that financial crises wreak terrible damage. And the way to avoid that damage is to have more serious regulation and to not have a housing bubble and a Wall Street bubble. But it's too late for that. That's not one of our options at this point. So we have to realize that it's going to take a really long time. And then we have to try to take some smart actions to speed it along a little bit. To me, that's things like a targeted payroll tax cut. Not for everybody, but for businesses that are actually adding workers.
This is a question actually for both of you, and I want to pick up on your mention, Joe, of Jamie Dimon and the issue of bank regulation. Jamie Dimon famously has said, you know what, we don't need more regulation. If we had regulation in place in other industries, we'd still be dealing with horse and buggies and we'd go backwards. How can we effectively regulate, but not, giving the banks their due, squeeze them too much?
First of all, I disagree strongly with what Jamie has been saying. It is not too much for the country to ask the big banks to have higher capital. If they'd had higher capital, we might not have gotten into this problem. It is not too much to ask that the country know what the bank's derivative exposure is to Greece, which, by the way, 3 years after the crisis, we don't know. The regulations that have been put in place will not kill the big banks. They won't kill the little banks. They're actually pretty tame.
David?
I agree with Joe. We've had lots of regulation in this country. It hasn't kept us from becoming the richest country in the world. I think capital is incredibly important. It's a cushion against something bad happening. And on top of more capital, I also think we should have a finance tax. That helps with our deficit, and it helps with future financial crises. I don't mean a tax on every transaction, but I mean a tax that basically acknowledges, look, banks get into crises, and let's make them pay now for the cost we know they are going to have over the next century.
So that's a good point about future financial crises, because there's going to be another one. Question is, though, how do you make people still care when the most recent financial crisis has not yet resulted in significant reform and change?
You know, that is a tough one. I mean, on the one hand, I do think there's still enormous amount of pent-up anger in the country, but there hasn't been the trauma that there was in the 1930s. Mm. And if you go back and look at the history of the 1930s, you basically find that most of the really powerful regulation like Glass-Steagall and the formation of the SEC stemmed from populist outrage at what had happened. And it does kind of feel to me like we haven't gotten to that point, maybe we won't get to that point, where there will be so much more outrage that we'll pass better regulations, more regulations. We'll do more of what we need to do.
David, pick up on that. Where is the outrage?
Part of the explanation is that this crisis never got nearly as bad as the Depression did. Lehman Brothers collapses in September of 2008. You have the Fed and the Bush administration being very aggressive immediately. You then have the Obama administration come in 4 months later and be even more aggressive. And you basically turn something that the economic data shows started as more severe than the Great Depression into something much, much less severe. And that just means we have a lot less outrage. And as a result, it's much harder to push through fundamental change.
David Leonhardt and Joe Nocera, columnists for the New York Times. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, some local flavor ripped from the pages of the Aspen Times, one of two local papers, I should point out. City Hall here wants to build up its water business, so it's doing a little market research. An informal survey yesterday behind City Hall showed Aspen City tap water tested better for taste, flavor, finish, and thirst quenchability than both Dasani and Fiji water. Cheaper probably, too, I'd bet. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this Thursday. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back here, Marketplace in the Raw. We're going to be live, studio audience and all. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.